You're listening to the FQXI podcast.
Today, our rundown of the top physics stories of 2013, as chosen by Ian Durham, continues.
And so I think from a foundational standpoint, from learning why the universe is the way it is and how it's made the way it's made, this, even though it seems like a pure math result, it is absolutely fascinating from a foundational physics standpoint because it removes an element of randomness from the universe. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating.
And Tejinder Verdi explains how the Higgs is inspiring budding physicists in Africa.
And so the thought was, can I do something in science education internationally that will make a significant impact? As I mentioned, CMS is a very international experiment. But one area was missing. We don't have any members from sub-Saharan Africa.
He's Brendan Foster.
And she's Zia Morali. Welcome to the new edition of the podcast from the Foundational Questions Institute. In the last edition, we left you with a cliffhanger, having just started our countdown of the five biggest physics stories of 2013.
Which have very kindly been chosen for us by FQXI member Ian Durham, a quantum physicist at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. This is actually the second podcast in a trilogy that will run in December and will culminate in Ian crowning this year's Best Physics Advance.
Yes, it's the FQXI List 2, the Desolation of Smog. Not that I'm suggesting that we're unnecessarily padding this countdown out across three podcasts. What would we gain by prolonging these podcasts? It's true we get paid per hour, but I promise you, we would never just needlessly chatter on about things that are totally unrelated to physics simply to fill time and earn ourselves more money.
That's something we would never, ever do. Which reminds me, Brendan, how is your cat Puffy doing these days?
Well, very good. Thank you for asking. The anger management classes are going very well.
I'm glad to hear that. Back to the list. If you missed part one of Ian's countdown, then you can visit the podcast page and listen to the first mini-podcast of December to hear what he chose at number five. But now, here's Ian with the physics advance that came in at number four on his list.
So my number four was there was a huge and totally out-of-the-blue, unexpected advance in prime number theory this year by a gentleman, Yiteng Zhang, who teaches at the University of New Hampshire, which is right near where I live. So it's kind of near and dear to my heart in that sense. It was fascinating because this is a guy who no one had ever heard of him. And in fact, the rumor had been going around that he had even worked at a Subway restaurant once to make ends meet. And he popped out this result related to something called the twin primes conjecture, which has been around for a long time. And the twin primes conjecture says that there are infinitely many pairs of primes that are separated by only two. So, for instance, the numbers 11 and 13 are both prime, and they're separated by two. And if you go up the list and you list out all the primes, you find these pairs of primes all the way up the list. And so there's this conjecture that you would continue to find these pairs all the way up the list as far as you can go, which is infinity. And that was the twin primes conjecture. But no one had been able to prove it. And as yet, they haven't proved it. But what Yiteng Zhang has done for the first time, because it had never moved past just a pure conjecture, he was able to show that even though the primes themselves get increasingly rarer as you go further out along the number line, you're never going to stop finding pairs of primes that are separated by at most 70 million. So instead of two, he had them 70 million.
70 million, what's the difference?
Well, I'll explain the difference in a minute. Just to mention, because then, this was in May, and then sometime just recently, mid-November, a postdoc at the University of Montreal, which is also not far from here, James Maynard, posted a preprint on archive.org where he got that number down to 600. So from 70 million down to 600. And this has just ignited a firestorm in mathematics. And Terence Tao has launched a program called the Polymath Project, where people are collaborating to try and get the number down even further, because obviously the goal is to get it down to 2, to prove that it is 2. But here's the thing. Here's what's important about the fact that it's any number. 70 million, 2, 600. I once read a book where someone described prime numbers as being what was left when you took out all the patterns. So you take all the multiples of 2, take those out, right? So, you know, you can count by 2s, you can count by 3s, you can count by 4s. You take all of that stuff out and you're left with these numbers. And they're the numbers that were left, or so had been said by more than one person before. They're what's left when you take all the patterns out, which implied that there was no pattern to them, that they were completely random.
Right. Okay.
And in fact, there's an element of randomness to prime numbers that is relied on in some physical applications of prime numbers. And from the foundational standpoint, what's fascinating about this result is that it implies that there is a pattern. Whether it's 70 million or 2 or 600, there's a pattern there, which means that the prime numbers are not completely random, that there is some kind of pattern. And usually patterns in nature correspond to some kind of symmetry. And in physics, we love symmetry because symmetries tell us an awful lot about how things work. We exploit symmetries all the time. And so I think from a foundational standpoint, from learning why the universe is the way it is and how it's made the way it's made, this, even though it seems like a pure math result, it is absolutely fascinating from a foundational physics standpoint because it removes an element of randomness from the universe. And that, to me, is absolutely fascinating.
Okay, well, I think you've done it. I think you've justified why it's in there at number 4.
I'm going to mention Peter Higgs here. So Peter Higgs, of course, won the Nobel Prize this year for the Higgs boson, co-won it with Englert. And he was interviewed and said that in today's academic culture or academic industry, I suppose you could call it, he said he wouldn't get a job. And that he, in fact, it had been a guarded secret at the University of Edinburgh that they had kept him for a while just because they thought, well, you know, if he wins the Nobel Prize, we'll keep him. And if he doesn't, we'll get rid of him kind of thing. Because what he did was really foundational. It took a long time. And he wasn't the kind of person who spit out a lot of papers, which is what's expected nowadays. Yiteng Zheng, who did this result in prime numbers, similarly had not published anything in years. He toiled in solitude for a long time. Now, Higgs didn't toil in solitude, but he worked very hard on a problem for a long time without demonstrable results. And suddenly you have a result. And that's very important in science and mathematics because you never know where that can lead and what it can lead to. One of the other similarities to the whole Higgs boson thing is that somebody also had said that Higgs's work was essentially pure mathematics. I mean, it's applied in the sense that the mathematics applied to physical things that we have now proved are actually exist, but it was still mathematics. And this is a mathematical result that we may not, you know, right now. And actually, we do know that prime numbers have a huge application to a number of areas of physics. But even so, if it isn't quite so obvious now, it may be obvious in the future.
And on the website, I'll put a link to not only some more information about the twin prime conjecture, but also the Guardian article where you can see what Peter Higgs had to say in full, which is, you know, very, very interesting, as you say. And doesn't make you wonder how things would have turned out if I guess he'd been a bit younger or maybe going through the system a bit later.
Well, and it makes you wonder a little bit about where science and physics and math are headed now, because are we going to get fewer of these amazing discoveries because of the way things are set up? Anyway.
That was Ian Durham in his prime. There'll be more from him later, and you can read more about these math whizzes on the podcast page, www.fqxi.org/community/podcast.
Now, the conversation there did turn to the Higgs boson, and, of course, the Nobel Prize in Physics this year was awarded to Higgs and Englert, for the theoretical groundwork predicting the particle's existence. Earlier this year, a team of LHC physicists that led the hunt for the Higgs received an award of their own at the Glittering Fundamental Physics Prize ceremony in Geneva, Switzerland. Reporter Corinne Pickemer met with one of those who shared the $3 million prize, Tejinder Verdi, at Imperial College London. He told her more about the discovery and his plans to use his share of the prize money to encourage interest in physics in Africa.
On the 4th of July 2012, physicists working at the ATLAS and CMS experiments at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva found evidence for the famed but elusive Higgs boson particle. The existence of this particle was first hypothesized independently by a number of theoretical physicists, including Peter Higgs and François Englert, in 1964. And after the initial sighting in 2012, the Higgs boson particle was confirmed on March 14, 2013. Finding the Higgs boson more or less completes the standard model physicists have been using to describe the basic building blocks of the visible universe and explain the forces that work within them. So perhaps unsurprisingly, this year's Nobel Prize for Physics went to Higgs and Englert for their prediction of the existence of this particle. But the experimental physicists behind the discovery of the particle itself have not gone unrewarded either. In 2012, Russian entrepreneur and venture capitalist Yuri Milner, who studied theoretical physics at Moscow State University, established the Fundamental Physics Prize to help advance our knowledge of the universe and also to promote the communication of the excitement of fundamental physics to wide audiences. It is currently the most lucrative prize in science, and winners are free to spend it as they see fit. A number of physicists who have been central to the CMS and ATLAS experiments over the past two decades shared a special fundamental physics prize of $3 million. One of its recipients was Tejinder Verdi, professor of physics at Imperial College London. I visited Verdi in his office to find out to what use he is putting his share. But first I asked him about the theoretical work in 1964 that paved the way for the discovery of the Higgs boson.
Some 50 years ago, there were three papers published in quick succession. And the first one was by François Englert and Robert Brout. The second one was from Peter Higgs. And the third one was from Tom Kibble, Jerry Guralnik, and Carl Hagen. And in these papers, they were pretty mathematical in nature. What these guys had postulated was that there would be a field which permeates the whole universe. And this field is such that fundamental particles would interact with this field and acquire mass. Mass is a very fundamental quantity. For example, the first particle that was discovered of the so-called standard model was the electron. Last year we found the 17th particle of the standard model, a very successful theory. Now the electron has a mass, and the question is, how does it get mass? Now if the electron did not have mass, it would travel at the speed of light. It would not be able to make atoms. There would be no structure. We would not be here talking. So this question actually goes to the heart of our existence. So from a mathematical idea, this momentous scientific endeavor was launched in a sense, but there were very many steps along the way. For many years, these papers were not really referred to. People didn't pay much attention to them. And that changed in 1967 through a paper by Tom Kibble, who's in this department. The electroweak theory came up, which is a theory which combines the interaction which we're very familiar with, electromagnetism, which is all around us, and something else which is called weak interaction, which is responsible for radioactivity and responsible for the burning of the sun. And these guys actually are the same things. And that actually launched this quest in trying to understand how the visible universe works. That unification led to some predictions. In fact, one of the predictions was a new particle called the Z boson. And that was found in CERN in 1983. When that happened, essentially many of the particles of the standard model had been discovered, but one key particle was missing, which was the Higgs boson, which actually is the keystone of the standard model. Soon after that time, people like me started thinking about doing experiments, and the LHC project was born, in a sense. Now, that was a project which was extremely ambitious because we were going into territory that we had not gone into as experimentalists. The detectors that we needed to do the physics at the Large Hadron Collider, some of them didn't exist, so we had to invent them. And so that was an endeavor of about 20 years. And the CMS experiment, the LHC, and the ATLAS experiment are the most complex scientific instruments ever built. And last year, ATLAS and CMS found a Higgs boson. And so in that sense, you can see this endeavor, which is launched by some theoretical papers 50 years ago, yielded a result last year.
So why is this particle so difficult to find?
One, its mass was not known. Its mass was rather high. So we found it at a mass of about 125 times the mass of the proton. So that's one thing. So you have to produce it first. So the previous generation of colliders either couldn't produce it or didn't produce it in sufficient quantities to be able to see it. Not only is it difficult to produce, it's also difficult to detect it because once it's produced, it decays immediately into many different ways. And one of the ways in which we found it was that it decays into two high-energy light particles, two high-energy photons. And that happens in two parts in 1,000. So not only is it difficult to produce, in that particular signature, it doesn't happen very often either. So you have to produce a very large number of these particles, and essentially only the LHC was able to do that.
So what does the actual physical discovery of this particle mean in terms of our understanding of the universe?
I think it completes the Standard Model. So it actually describes extremely well the visible universe. Now I say visible very carefully, because we know there is dark matter out there, and we also know there is dark energy. And these constitute 95% of the energy matter density of the universe. So we know a lot about 5%, but we don't know much about the other 95%. So for those 5%, it's a very successful theory. In a sense, it closes a chapter of our understanding of the visible universe, but the story is not obviously finished.
So it is very well deserved that those people who came up with those ideas 50 years ago got the Nobel Prize for it.
This is worthy of a Nobel Prize, yes.
While the award of the Nobel Prize received most mainstream coverage, Verdi's contribution, along with six other scientists involved in the ATLAS and CMS experiments, resulted in them being awarded the Fundamental Physics Prize. Verdi is now using the money from his award to try to inspire a whole new generation of potential physicists.
In a sense, it is a personal prize, but we couldn't have found the Higgs boson without the efforts of a very large number of people. For example, CMS has about 3,000 scientists and engineers from 40 countries. And so the thought was, can I do something in science education internationally that will make a significant impact? As I mentioned, CMS is a very international experiment. But one area was missing. We don't have any members from sub-Saharan Africa. I was born in Kenya. I was raised there. I went to school there, primary education. Most of my secondary education was done in Kenya. And then I came over to the UK to do my O-levels and A-levels, and then the university education. And that opened the doors to do research. So I've had tremendous opportunities. So to think about somebody going to school on the shores of Lake Victoria and working on the most complex scientific instrument ever built and having had a major part in doing it meant that, you know, I really ought to see if the opportunities can also be afforded to the places where I came from. I believe the impact can be most significant in secondary education, where you have to capture the imaginations of the young into doing science or engineering or whatever. If you have a scientific literate population, then you can make progress economically much more rapidly than without. And so I thought, well, maybe secondary education is where one can make a difference. And it wouldn't cost that much. And you can actually reach a large number of people. And then I learned that there was a program from the Institute of Physics in the UK, which was actually further training physics teachers in eastern Uganda. And they've trained about 500 teachers in the last few years. And CERN has a teachers program, where they bring teachers from many, many different countries to spend a few weeks. And people at CERN give them lectures and they can look at the experiments. And so I got a couple of teachers from Uganda and Kenya to come over, and they really enjoyed it. one of the things that tends to be not available as much as it ought to be is the scientific equipment to do experiments, to capture the imagination. You know, you teach pupils something. If you can make that come alive by doing an experiment and proving to themselves that what they've been taught is indeed true, that sticks even more. And some of the equipment doesn't have to be, or quite a bit of the equipment doesn't have to be very complicated or costly, and can be locally produced. So this is another aspect of the program, to provide or make scientific equipment for doing experiments, and also pool the resources, and so other schools around the area can do this. So that kind of thing would be quite effective, and it will actually reach many, many thousands of pupils as such.
I guess once the prize money is spent, presumably you are building on the collaborations you've created with the IOP to keep the project going.
I think that's also an interesting issue, because in the end that goes into fundraising. And perhaps the fact that I'm associated with a very big scientific endeavor, which has been quite successful, and hopefully even more success in the future, we make more discoveries, that possibly opens doors, so I'll be exploring those kind of possibilities, yes.
So I know it's only early days, but have you got a sense as yet of how it's been received both at CERN and in Africa?
I think people at CERN were quite pleased, because they do wish to spread science education as one of their missions. And also another mission is to bring nations together through science. So in that sense, they are quite open to this, and so they were very pleased to have these teachers come over, and hopefully that will continue. I think the teachers themselves enjoyed it enormously. And through the programs like the IOP ones, I know that they do make an impact. So I think, you know, it is small scale, clearly, but, you know, I think they are effective, and maybe they can be made to larger scales if they're giving positive results.
Initiatives such as Verdi's can potentially make a real difference to the educational opportunities in countries like Kenya and Uganda, and it also fits in well with the spirit of the prize, which aims to spread knowledge about the workings of the natural world and the universe to as many people as possible. As for the future of the Large Hadron Collider, I ended the interview by asking Verdi what else he thinks is in store at CERN that will further our understanding of the universe in the next 10 years or so.
Conceiving these experiments and getting them built, we've just started exploiting them. Now, we hope to find physics beyond the Standard Model, which we all believe is there. Now, our belief is one thing, what nature has done is another. Because we were talking about this Nobel Prize. If he had not done the experiment, it wouldn't be obvious that that idea is correct. And so really the experiments have to tell us which way we have to go to make progress. One other aspect is that once you find a new particle like a Higgs boson, the next thing we do is to study it in great detail. In which context has nature placed it? What are its exact properties? And can one get clues as to what is beyond it by studying it in great detail? That in itself is a huge program of work of 10, 15 years. So I wouldn't be surprised if the LHC experiments are still going in 2030.
Thank you to Tejinder Verdi for chatting with Karin Pikema there. So does the Nobel Prize in Physics make Ian Durham's list?
You'll just have to wait and see, Brendan, because returning now to my interview with Ian Durham, here he is telling us what came in at number three.
This is one of my favorites. Hofstadter's butterfly. So it really has nothing to do with butterflies, but it's a pure physics thing. Some of you may be familiar with Douglas Hofstadter, wrote the Pulitzer Prize winning book Gerda Lescher-Bach back in the 70s. And he works on consciousness and language and artificial intelligence these days. But he actually was a physicist at one time. And in 1976, he made a prediction. He calculated the energy levels of electrons exposed to a magnetic field in a two-dimensional lattice. And he treated these electrons as this sort of ideal, what are called block electrons, which means they don't interact with one another. And they move in sort of a periodic electric potential that's related to the way the lattice is set up. And what he discovered, ultimately, was that, you know, it's a little bit more complicated than this, but what he discovered was that the pattern that describes the behavior of these electrons in this magnetic field is a fractal pattern and looks a little bit like a butterfly. Actually, it looks a lot like a butterfly. So these were predicted back in 1976, and they grew to be called Hofstadter's butterfly. Well, no one had ever actually seen these things until just this year, when two teams actually, a team of physicists from Columbia University, the City College of New York, the University of Central Florida, and Tohoku University, and the National Institutes of Material Science in Japan, that was one team, as well as a team that included people at the University of Manchester and Lancaster in the UK and France's National Lab for High Magnetic Fields and also the Institute of Material Science in Madrid. And then there was also a third team that had MIT folks who were teamed up sort of with the same Japanese folks who were teamed up with the Columbia group. So anyway, lots of people. What they did is they looked at graphene, which of course, graphene won a Nobel Prize recently, 2 years ago, I believe it was.
Yeah.
Graphene is this fascinating structure. It's like if you had a sheet of graphene, it would be like a sheet of graphite that's literally only one atom thick, a single atom thick lattice of carbon atoms. And it has some fascinating properties, including the fact that it's apparently stronger than steel. At any rate, these teams looked at graphene on an extremely flat surface of boron nitride crystal and were able to visualize whenever the patterns, when they overlaid the graphene over the top of the boron nitride, they could see sometimes the patterns would match up. And by tweaking the relative orientation of these lattices, they could create these, what they would call super lattices with appropriate spacing. It's kind of like just get them to line up just right and it would look like one lattice. And when you take the energy spectrum of this and visualized it, you got essentially Hofstadter's butterfly. And one of the reasons I really, really like this, aside from the fact that it takes a 40-year-old prediction, almost 40-year-old prediction, and suddenly finds it in nature. But one of the other things that I really like about this, and what this relates to how Hofstadter's career has gone, there's a beauty in this. There's a symmetry and a beauty to this. And in fact, Hofstadter gave up on physics to basically study beauty in nature, mm-hmm. In a sense. I mean, that's kind of simplifying it a lot. But that's essentially what he did. You almost get the impression that this may have had something to do with it. And here we are, 40 years later, and we've actually finally seen this. And the result, it just demonstrates how beautiful nature can be. I mean, just the mere name Hofstadter's butterfly conjures up so many great things, you know, great ideas in one's head. That's why I had it up here, because I just was fascinated by this. I thought it was a great discovery. You know, aside from the amazing physics that were required to make it happen, it confirmed a 40-year-old prediction, and it had all the elements of a great physics problem. It had symmetry, but then it added that element of beauty to it to show physics isn't just all about crunching numbers. Sometimes it's about seeing patterns, and actually it's all about seeing patterns and visualizing those patterns. Sometimes those patterns can be beautiful.
When we were discussing one of the earlier items on your list, and we talked about this quote by Peter Higgs talking about the academic culture and how he wouldn't get a job today, I'm just reading through this report on the Hofstadter butterfly in Nature, and Hofstadter is talking about how his advisor was very unimpressed when he came up with this in the 1970s. He scornfully called the nesting pattern that this upstart youngster claimed to see mere numerology. He even told me that I would be unable to get a PhD for this kind of work.
Which is fascinating. And it's funny because I've actually, many years ago, studied some old cosmology theories and that were accused of being numerological at various times. And I suppose in ways they are. But I think it goes back to the fact that even Einstein, you know, saw beauty in the mathematics. And I think scientists see beauty, and you have to see beauty in your work. And sometimes we're rewarded by actual visualizations of it where other people can maybe appreciate what we see. And I think this is a case of that. You know, does it have any practical relevance? Probably not, but it's a beautiful result. And I think that is just as important as a practical one.
And then I guess talking about, you know, really beautiful images, perhaps, in science, this year we had the direct observation of hydrogen orbitals. And I think that's something that a lot of people were talking about. So even though it's not sort of got an official placing on this list, is it worth a mention?
It's worth a mention. I can tell you why it's not on the list. It's not on the list because someone actually did it before.
Okay.
A group was able to directly observe the orbital structure of an excited hydrogen atom, meaning literally look at it, you know, not visualize it in the sense of, oh, taking some math and turning it into some random picture on a computer. This was literally seeing visually. Of course, this brings into question, being that we're FQXI, this brings into question, what does it mean to visualize anyway? Nevertheless, they were able to make it so that you were actually looking at it. So they called it a quantum microscope. The reason it's not on my list is because someone already did it. So it's not that new. About 4 years ago or so, another group did it with a different method. They were not looking at hydrogen. They were looking at carbon. They were using something called field emission electron microscopy, which were basically direct imaging of the intraatomic electron structure in carbon chains. And that's basically the same idea. You're literally looking at the electron structure, so the orbitals, the wave functions. Now, of course, this has some interesting implications for the wave function.
Well, now you mentioned the wave function, and, you know, looking at reports of this in the news, I've seen this reported as the first time we're directly seeing a quantum wave function. So, you know, is that the right terminology to be using here? Is that something we should be getting excited about, whether or not it's the first time?
No.
Right, okay, absolutely just to clear that up.
There's still debate about this, but in theory, you can't directly observe a wave function, in theory, because you would collapse it if you believe in the collapse interpretation. But the point is that, you know, it's not really clear exactly what this quantum microscope is looking at from the standpoint of how do we match that up with the theoretical description. I mean, it's clear that we're looking at the electron structure. But, you know, when we're looking at it, are we really seeing the wave function? Well, we're seeing an orbital, but it's debatable whether we're actually seeing the wave function. This goes back to one of last year's top five, which was the PBR result about whether the wave function is statistical or not. If this really is the wave function that we're seeing, then I suppose the wave function really isn't statistical. But I think the jury's still out on what it is actually that you're looking at. I would hesitate to say, yes, you're looking at the wave function. Yeah, I think more work needs to be done to figure out exactly what they're observing here. But like I said, it's been done before. And again, it also comes down to a subtle question of when we say we're seeing it and looking at it, what does that mean? You know, because when I make observations with a radio telescope, which I've done, I get data that I then turn into a, quote, picture.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Am I really seeing that? You know, am I really seeing what I'm seeing? I'm taking information that's coming via electromagnetic interactions with the telescope, and I'm turning that data and numbers and stuff into a picture that I then absorb in my brain. Does that really mean I'm seeing what's there? I mean, there are some questions that have to be answered about that before I'm willing to say, hey, yes, we're actually seeing the wave function.
Thank you again, Ian. There's more about his top picks of 2013 on the website.
www.fqxi.org/community/podcast. And we'll be revealing Ian's choice of the top physics stories that come in at number 2 and number 1 in the final installment of our December podcast trilogy.
The FQXI Games, Albatross.
Albatross?
The FQXI Games, Mockingjay. I read the first book. I didn't enjoy it.
For now, thank you to Tejinder Verdi and Corinne Pickamer.
And to Katniss Durham.
Ian Durham.
She's been Zia Morali.
And he's been Brendan Foster.
At least the Twilight Saga used titles that were related to astronomy.